Have you ever looked back at how the news covered events from your childhood and cringed? A scandal that was framed in a way that now makes you uncomfortable? Like how Mary Kay Letourneau's sexual assault of a student got framed by some as a kid who got lucky with his teacher. Maybe it's a punchline or a headline or the lead of a news story that now feels wrong.
Miss America Vanessa Williams took off her clothes, and now she's being asked to give up her crown within 72 hours.
A podcast called In Retrospect unravels these kinds of moments, pulls apart the stories that have shaped our culture. Hosted by award-winning journalists Susie Banacharam and Jessica Bennett, In Retrospect dives into cultural moments past and present. Susie, Jessica, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, thanks.
I want to start with the episode that got me hooked on your podcast, In Retrospect. We recently had Jill Cement on our show to talk about her memoir, Consent. It details her relationship with her husband, which began when she was his student. We talked about how relationships between teachers and their students weren't seen, you know, 40, 50 years ago, as harmful then as they are now. And it immediately reminded me of a television show from my teenage years, which sent me down a rabbit hole, which led me to your podcast episode about Dawson's Creek and the way it romanticized a relationship between a 15-year-old Pacey and his 36-year-old teacher. And what it sounds like we're all about the same age. So this was like sort of a revelatory moment for you guys as well. This was must-see TV if you were a teen in the 90s.
It was absolutely must-see TV. In fact, it was so must-see that at some point in my sophomore year, the New York Times came to my high school in Seattle, a public high school in Seattle. I'm not sure why they chose us to sit in on one of our Dawson's Creek watch parties.
And the relationship between Pacey and his teacher, Miss Jacobs, it's made to seem like a relationship that we're rooting for, that we want to happen. And what I find fascinating in going back and looking at it as an adult woman was that Pacey was also the aggressor, the pursuer in the storyline.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember watching this storyline and thinking, oh God, I'm really rooting for them. Like, this is illicit, but it's hot, and we really want them to end up together, and it's kind of cool. And no one in my friend group, this is just talking it, at age 15 or whatever we were, was saying like, this is a little creepy and weird. And the interesting thing, and we talk about this in the podcast, is I think that we're reversed. We're Pacey, the girl, and Miss Jacobs, Mr. Jacobs. We might have seen it a little bit differently.
Yeah, this is also, although, oh, go ahead.
Sorry, this is Susie. I know, I was going to say, although an interesting thing about that is that Pretty Little Liars, which is sort of like a little bit beyond our age group, which I watched anyway, because I'll watch any teen show, did have a relationship between a girl and a teacher. And that was also very romanticized. So I think this sort of theme in teen shows has always been treated in a way that's odd, that's always like a bit romantic, like an illicit love affair between sort of like a Romeo and Juliet, rather than what it is, which is abuse. I mean, if we're just being honest.
Yeah. Dawson's Creek aired in 1998, which was a year after Mary Kay Letourneau was sentenced to 7 years in prison for her rape of a 12-year-old student who later becomes her husband, which is a whole other thing to unpack. But I remember the Mary Kay Letourneau case, and I do remember the way it was framed in the media, at least by some at the time, that he was a kid who got lucky with his hot teacher.
And in fact, there was a whole culture that emerged from it. I mean, there were like songs at the time. There was that Van Halen song called Literally Hot for Teacher. The headlines were things like star-crossed lovers. I think that at one point we went back through digging through old headlines and old newspaper articles about this and old video interviews. And the questions that were asked were just things like, oh, are you rooting for them? Like, how, what chance do you give them? Not like, do you think this is appropriate? And for me, this is just talking, So I was in Seattle at the time. Mary, this case of Mary Kay Letourneau was outside of Seattle at a school not so far away. This was happening around the same time that Dawson's Creek had this storyline. So this idea of younger student and older teacher in both cases where the student was a male was playing out both in real life and in teen pop.
And you talk about the how you think about these situations now that you're adults on your podcast, and I want to play a quick cut from that.
I don't really struggle with saying that it just is so blatantly wrong, right? It's so clear to me that a 34-year-old woman shouldn't be having sex with a 12-year-old boy, and I don't call it like an affair or like a sexual encounter. I'm like, oh yeah, when Mary Kay Letourneau obviously assaulted her 12-year-old student. And so
Right.
it's interesting that the reason we struggle with this is because we've watched the relationship play out in a way that really supports that idea. And that
And
is the
unfold.
idea that Mary Kay was really pushing in the press, and that the press kind of accepted her version of events because there was this bias that like a 12-year-old boy would love to have sex with Mary Kay Letourneau because she was like hot. And that is all the 12-year-old boys care about.
Why do you think it got covered that way? 'Cause like I remember it. I was still pretty young in this moment, but like I remember this being, I didn't have the mind at the time to really understand what it meant, but he was 12 and she was 34.
Well, I think that's something that we really thought about when we did the research because I didn't remember him as having been 12 either. I mean, I think there's something that was sort of obscured in the coverage because he didn't look quite as young as he was. Although, when you look at the pictures, he did look very young, to be clear. But I think, it was one of the first big cases like this. There have obviously been subsequently a lot more cases. And one thing I've noticed is now that there's like a few cases a year, and they don't even get a lot of attention because it's become like a fairly common story. Although, they get arrested, so that's I guess a benefit that they get arrested sooner. But I think it's because of this idea that boys just want to have sex, that boys want to be sexualized, boys want to be drawn into these kinds of encounters. So we don't really see Mary Kay as a predator in this scenario, but I will say that we listened to a lot of interviews that they have done since. And there was this one particularly odd one where she was really pushing him in the interview to say he had been the aggressor. And she used this anecdote about how when he had been a student of hers when he was like 8 or something to indicate that it was like one of the first times he'd flirted with her. And it really was like deranged. When I
Oh my
was watching
God.
her, like, what is happening? And interestingly, last year that movie came out, May, December, and it just shows how much this, story still has cultural impact, right? That movie was, loosely based on the Mary Kay Letourneau story. But some scenes from the movie, some of the dialogue were very similar to this interview I had seen that was like an Australian TV interview. So I think they had gone back and looked at that interview, and in it, at that point, the boy in that case was the age Mary Kay Letourneau was when their affair started. And you could see that it had begun to dawn on him how wild it was that she had begun an affair with a child. So even I think for, the people involved in the story, they didn't really have the language or the tools to cope with it in a meaningful way.
Yeah, Mary Kay Letourneau passed away a couple of years ago, but Vili Plow, the young boy who's now an adult man, I think he's 41, so he's all grown up. But yeah, you read about him too, and he definitely had a complicated, I mean, he was a father of two at 15, which is life-changing for any young teenager. But it's also been written that he's struggled with alcoholism, he struggled with depression, that you can kind of see it in those later interviews that he's sort of recognizing as an adult what it would mean for him at, say, 34 to pursue a 12-year-old.
100%. I mean, you can just see that in the interviews he does. But also, I think he has talked about this a little bit. Having daughters, I think, really also impacted that because I'm sure he looked at his 12-year-old daughters and thought to himself, how could anyone look at this 12-year-old and see her as a sexual object? So I think, in a lot of ways, beyond just the fact that it was a sexual assault. I mean, there's just no way to, justify like a 30-something-year-old woman sleeping with a 12-year-old. I think the impact on his life, I mean, sort of what it stole from him that he had these kids when he was essentially like 13 or 14, and then he, never got to live a normal life. Like, there was a lot of impacts to him that were beyond just the sexual abuse. I think there was just a really emotionally difficult relationship between the two of them. And interestingly, they got divorced before she passed, but he was still with her when she passed. I mean, their relationship, I mean, I guess you have to call it a relationship because they did get married, and have a couple kids, but it was till the end, it sort of had a hold on him that he wasn't able to escape.
Another episode deep dives into the story of the Menendez brothers. So it's Lyle and Eric, who were convicted of murdering their parents in 1996. I was stunned in listening to the episode by how little credit the news, like the media collectively, gave to their allegations of rape and sexual assault by their father at the time. It was just dismissed as a story they fabricated, essentially, to get out of this murder.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually fascinated by this too. I became interested in the Menendez case again because the TikTok sort of memeing
rediscovered
of it.
Yeah,
TikTok generation rediscovered it, but then there was sort of this viral moment where they were posting clips from the trial and posting interviews with the boys. And I remembered this the way most people of that era remembered it. I remembered it as a story about two spoiled rich kids in Beverly Hills who had their, allowances essentially cut off or were afraid they were going to be cut off and had killed their parents for their money. And that was very much the narrative that played out, nationally during the time of this story. And this story did get a lot of national attention. It was a huge story at the time. And I was fascinated to go back because it's not just that they told this story of having been abused as children, it's that it was corroborated by a lot of evidence at the time. And there were people in their lives, family members, who testified that they were aware of the abuse. So what's wild about the way the media covered this story, and I really haven't even now wrapped my head around why they did it in this way, is that there was a lot of reasons to believe them, but I think it was so uncomfortable at the time to imagine two young boys being sexually abused by their father that there was almost this unwillingness to see the possibility that that could have been what happened here.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Is there a moment from history that now looks different to you in retrospect? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513. Or you can email allsides at WOSU.org. Jessica, some of the details that you guys recount in the Menendez episode were incredibly disturbing. There's this one very specific detail about why one of the brothers is obsessed with lemons. And it felt to me just like, feels like that's a really hard thing to fake. Or, like, if you were going to make up a story of sexual abuse, would you have those weirdly specific details? Without being too graphic, he eats lemons to get a certain taste out of his mouth repeatedly because it will clear. And it ends up in a hung jury the first time it gets tried, right? Like, they can't make up their minds. They're very divided.
Yeah, Susie, you remember the details more than I do. But, the interesting thing is, we went into this podcast being like, okay, we want to look back in these moments in history, whether it's crime or pop culture or things we consumed or language. And as journalists, of course, we ended up looking at our role or the media's role in it. And I think that that's a really big part of this, because who was covering these cases at the time, our collective understanding about things like sexual abuse, assault, consent, like even the language around it. We didn't have the word consent. People weren't talking about that back then. And so all of these kind of gender dynamics and lack of information and potentially the people covering the stories go into how the public perceived them. And so to hear Susie say, And this was my memory too. Like, yeah, we remember this. The storyline that took off and that cemented in our brains was of these two spoiled rich kids who like killed their parents for their allowance. And it was so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, they are convicted, but recently there's been new evidence that has come to light. One of the details that I find particularly disturbing is their father, Jose Menendez, was an RCA executive, and he was involved in the creation and promotion of Menudo, that Latin American boy band. And one of the members has now come out and said, Jose Menendez raped me too, essentially.
Yeah, this was a fascinating detail I found in researching this case. So, the boys have been in prison now. They are, in prison indefinitely. I think they both got life sentences. And it is true that initially the jury was hung, and the reason they went away for so long, or I suppose one of the reasons, is that the judge did not allow a lot of the evidence of the abuse in the second case. A lot of the things that sort of led to the jury having an understanding of the dynamics in this house, which really was a house of horrors. I mean, the lemon detail is the one that I found most shocking. But let me tell you that when you listen to their testimony, it is all just really disturbing. And it is hard not to be like really empathetic to these two young boys. And by the way, I don't think anyone thought they should completely get off for killing their parents. It was a particularly brutal murder. But I think the hope was is that they wouldn't get
That it would
life
be
sentences.
manslaughter.
Yeah, it would be manslaughter as opposed to murder. And so what's happened since is that, they have actually said, I think one of the boys, I can't remember which one, I guess now men, has said that prison has actually been a relief, compared to growing up in that house, right? So they have not pursued a ton of appeals, honestly. But recently, they have started to gain traction on a possible appeal because two things have happened. One is this story you mentioned that one of the boys in Menudo had this memory of having been raped by an RCA executive. He had never made the connection that it was the Menendez's father. And it came out because a journalist reached out to him. There had been a tip, there had been a note from one of the assistants who had been working at RCA at the time that the father was obsessed with Menudo. And so a journalist who's been sort of working this case for a long time thought to themselves, well, that's interesting. Maybe there was some tie, and reached out to this, man who had been in Menudo. And he was like, yes, I remember going to this, executive's house. And he describes the house, and it is the house of the Menendez brothers when they lived in New Jersey. And so that is, a really big piece of evidence. I mean, it's an independent corroboration that this man was a sexual sadist who was sexually abusing young boys. But also, there's another thing that has been found, which is this letter that one of the brothers wrote his cousin. And in the letter, which was contemporaneous and was just months before what happened, he describes that it's still happening with his father. He sort of describes the abuse in somewhat oblique terms, but in pretty clear terms, and that he is, trying his best to sort of cope with this abuse. So there is a good shot. I spoke to one of their lawyers that they will get an appeal. And, if that is the case and they are, in fact, able to make a deal on manslaughter, they will get out, because they have served I think the max on manslaughter. So what's interesting about this particular story is not just the revisiting, but that the revisiting by this new generation who was able to understand the nuances of this story in a different and meaningful way will have to some degree led to this renewed interest in the story and may lead to their release. So, TikTok does do some amazing things.
Yeah, the detail that stuck out to me most was that when the first trial hung, it was split along gender lines. So the men didn't think the father had abused the sons, but the women thought that it was true. And I think that tells you a lot about culturally where we were, not only in terms of homosexuality, but in sexual assault and how we viewed it.
Yeah, I think there just wasn't an understanding that boys, dealt with this kind of abuse. And this abuse that they described was so vicious. I think it was also the severity of it. It was almost like too much to absorb that it could be possible that these two boys could have been abused in this way in such an incredibly intense way for so long, and that the mother knew. I mean, I think that was the other detail that came out of trial that was pretty upsetting and was also corroborated by another family member.
That was Susie Banacharam, one of the hosts of the podcast In Retrospect. Coming up, we're going to explore how language shapes the news we cover. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Problematic. It's a word we attribute to celebrities, old movies, social media comments. But when people say something is problematic, what do we really mean? And what are the effects of using this kind of language? We're talking about that and the still with me this hour are Susie Banacharam and Jessica Bennett, hosts of the podcast In Retrospect. I want to play a clip from the podcast about the word problematic.
But it's become this catch-all for something you don't like, but can't really describe or don't really want to be pressed to describe why. Or here are some of the other definitions. A code word for anything considered to be politically incorrect. I think that's pretty true. Also this one, LOL, a catch-all insult used to negatively describe something you don't like, but can't describe why.
Yeah, it does feel really muddy.
Jessica, why is this word problematic so hard to define?
Well, I think it's not hard to define in its actual definition, but as a word person, as we all are, as people who communicate for a living, you're always trying to be as specific as possible. You know, I, as a writer, I want my readers to understand what is problematic about something, what the problem is. And yet in this kind of culture war, Twitter, 140, 240, whatever, however many characters it is in that world that we live in, it's much easier to take something you don't like. The thing that I think it was last week was Blake Lively using the word tranny in an interview 12 years ago and simply call it problematic. And what does problematic mean? I don't know. Maybe it means you're kind of canceled. And you can't really defend yourself against it because you may not know what exactly the problem is with the thing that you have said. And so it irks me as a writer, and I think it irks Susie too, which is why we did an episode about it, that it is so overused as to have become meaningless.
Yeah, Blake Lively is having a lot of, quote, problematic issues lately, particularly yes. with the marketing of her new movie.
She's our problematic fave, if you will, of the moment.
Yeah. And it's become such a catch-all word to describe a whole variety of things. I wonder, why do you think we've seen such a rise in its usage? Is it just because it's really hard to defend against?
Well, I think we're living in an age where these terms that can be used to describe complex behavior or language have taken off. Like, we see this happen on TikTok all the time. There's all sorts of sort of faux armchair psychology that is used to describe things. We're all talking about setting boundaries. You know, we all have trauma, whether or not it is actual real diagnosed or undiagnosed trauma. We are using these words, and sometimes they can be really useful and utilitarian to describe behaviors. But I also think that problematic is an easy way to give a clapback. And we are living in a clapback shutdown culture. You know, people want to shut someone down. They want to have fights and outrage constantly on the internet. And calling someone problematic is a really easy way to shut down conversation, which, of course, one could argue, and I think we would argue, is really not helping anyone at this point. Like, we should actually be talking to each other and trying to understand one another. But this is a simple way to shut down a conversation and to basically make someone look bad without giving them the opportunity to explain, which of course sometimes is valid. Sometimes behavior really is problematic. It may be racist, it may be sexist, it may be homophobic. Mm. But if that's the case, I would argue, try using those words instead.
Yeah, one of your episodes is about the actress Robin Givens and her tumultuous marriage to boxing champion Mike Tyson. And I'm hesitant to use the word, but it's the really problematic, perhaps, coverage of their marriage and the abuse and their divorce. And one of the words that gets used a lot to describe Robin and her mother is ambitious. And it gets used in a really pejorative way. And I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about Robin Givens, if people don't remember, and how she gets labeled too ambitious.
Yeah, Robin Givens is such a fascinating story to me. So this episode begins with this interview that Robin Givens and her then husband, Mike Tyson, give together. They are both very young, in their early 20s when they give this interview. And there have been a number of media reports at this time that he is being physically abusive to her, and it has been witnessed by people. So there's pretty good evidence that he's physically abusive to her. And they give this interview to Barbara Walters, who, you know, at that time was sort of the preeminent interviewer in America. It's where you went if you were a celebrity. And she straight up asks if he's being physically abusive. And Robin sort of obliquely but clearly answers that she is sometimes afraid of him. And he is sitting next to her when she says this, and he does not object to this characterization of their marriage. And as part of that interview, they also talk about him having mental health issues. He has recently seen a therapist and has been diagnosed with some mental health issues. So this interview, when you watch it today, your instinct, I mean, I think, you know, anybody's instinct would be to feel just enormous empathy for her, right? I mean, here she is on national television with her incredibly famous husband, who is the heavyweight champion of the world at that time. And she is admitting that he is frightening to her, that he has done things that frighten her. And the result of this interview is just shocking when you go back and look at it. What ends up happening is that she literally becomes known, and this is published in articles and, you know, headlines, as the most hated woman in America. The reaction that people have to this interview is, how dare she do this to Mike Tyson? How could she humiliate her husband in this way? Not how could her husband lay hands on her, which is what you would expect the reaction to be. And part of the way in which she is villainized for this assumption that she's a gold digger and that she's ambitious and she's using him to further her ambitions. It should be said that Robin Givens at this time was on a hit TV show. I mean, she was successful in her own right. It's not like when she married Mike Tyson, she was some nobody. But even if she had been, it wouldn't have justified this abuse of her. And, you know, over the years, he has barely denied it, if not fully admitted it. There was a biography of him that came out around that same time where he openly said, the interviewer, who was a very friendly interviewer for a book he was doing on Mike Tyson, asked him, what's the best punch you ever threw? And clearly intended for the answer to be something from the ring. And instead, Mike Tyson describes punching Robin Givens and does it, you know, in this sort of joking way in which he's laughing about having landed this punch on her that sent her reeling. So, you know, this idea that ambitious women deserve whatever happens to them, that sort of ambition is equal to being cold and calculating, and that somehow it meant she was a gold digger, that she was just after his money, and that she must be making up these allegations, although there was evidence that he provided that they were real. And what's fascinating to me about this story is, beyond just what happened with Robin Givens, who, by the way, is an amazing actress, has gone on to have a career, would really have been valid if she had decided to leave public life. I mean, really went through something that would have crushed most people, but survived this torrent and brick by brick, you know, sort of rebuilt her life and has gone on to have an amazing career, is that then Mike Tyson is actually convicted of raping another young woman. He goes to jail. And now in culture, we treat Mike Tyson as sort of this benevolent, adorable uncle. Like, he has had an amazing career by any standard, but certainly for someone convicted of rape and who, you know, admitted to abusing his wife. So I think it's really a question that I ask myself a lot, why Mike Tyson has escaped this, you know, sort of cultural reckoning that a lot of other people have had. I mean, you know, not that long ago, I just like turned on the television and he was on the Jimmy Kimmel show. And, you know, it's just like, oh, you know, Uncle Mike, like if they treat him like he's just such a sweet, funny, goofy guy. I'm like, that seems like it's really, really not acknowledging the reality of who this person is.
Yeah, he escapes it in a way that Bill Cosby does not. Now, yeah. Cosby also weirdly appears in the Mike Tyson, Robin Givens story. So there's a strange cameo there. Like you, I do have questions about the time that she lived with the Bill Cosby, but no answers as of yet.
No answers. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that came up when we were doing these episodes that almost invariably in every episode, some other very bad man, known bad person appears in the episode. So it's like we'll be doing an episode about someone and then Les Moonves will somehow make a cameo, or Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby. I mean, it is just the case that these guys were always circling around when terrible things were happening.
Yeah. And what I love about the podcast in retrospect is that you also are pretty open about Mike Tyson's troubled childhood, about his mental health struggles, about his sexual assault that he's only very recently begun to talk about the promoters who were honestly predatory. Like, one of the reasons people know so much about their relationship at the time is that the promoters who were arguably fleecing Mike Tyson for a lot of his money, their contracts get renegotiated by Robin and her mother.
Yes. So this is an interesting part of the story that I really did not know at all, which is that essentially what's happening is this media campaign against her is being orchestrated in the background by his managers and agents, because her mother is this very astute businesswoman, an ambitious woman, you know, for all that implies. And she has built this million-dollar business, this, you know, multi-million-dollar business on her own. And so when they become involved in Mike's life, he really doesn't have anyone to protect him. His parents weren't involved in his life. The coach that had really raised him had passed. And so she takes a look at his business arrangements and is like, you're being fleeced. And she renegotiates these contracts. And as a result, they hate her and Robin. They hate Robin and her mother. And so they orchestrate this campaign against her in the media, which is why everyone is primed to hate her before this interview even happens, right? For months, they've been leaking stories about her. And that also speaks to something I think we learned in this series and we knew, but we saw more of, which is that the person who knows how to control the media narrative often wins the story, right? It's sort of like, and we didn't actually cover this particular case, but the Woody Allen, Mia Farrow case, right? Where he had this really complex machinery that knew how to push a narrative. And so they just pushed the narrative that Mia Farrow was crazy and, you know, it was her fault and she made up these allegations. And he was able to kind of win that media narrative at the time. But now when it's reexamined, it's kind of hard to accept that that's how it played out. And we still see that today, right? I mean, we see that in much more recent examples. It's why Justin Timberlake was able to really paint Britney Spears in a certain way at that time. And, you know, more recently, why Johnny Depp was able to paint Amber Heard in a very specific way. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes that may not be obvious to us, but that also contributes to the way we hear stories and how we are meant to understand them.
I wonder, and this is really a question for both of you, how has doing in retrospect changed the way you approach your work as reporters?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think first off, I always look back at the coverage of something at the time because it can be such an interesting marker, an indicator of how that thing was understood. But I also think we look for patterns, you know, like Susie was mentioning, Britney Spears, these other more present day cases. typically something like that has occurred before, and there's some learning you can get from it in looking back at how that thing was covered over time. You know, for also for what it's worth, we're not entirely immune to this. Like, we've looked back at our own stories and thought to ourselves, like, that's kind of cringe in retrospect. Like, we could have done that a little differently. So I think this is part of a healthy process of re-examining the way that we saw stories in the past. But I also think it reminds us how short the cultural memory is. You know, these narratives take hold, and we do not have the cognitive space to remember every last detail. And so sometimes it really does take uprooting and looking back and unearthing all these details to think, oh my God, this was so much more complex. And yet this thing has just lived on in the cultural imagination as really linear and simple.
I also wonder, what do you think we'll be looking back on from current coverage in retrospect in, say, 10 or 20 years that'll make us cringe?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial is one that Susie and I don't even think we were recording the podcast at the time, but we were like on Zoom with each other while watching it every day, stuck at home. Was this still the pandemic? And just so fascinated by what was occurring, but also all of these channels that were live streaming it. And so anyone could jump into the chat. And so observing the chat and how people were talking about these two people in the chat, that was one. I think that, you know, in this age of short form content and TikTok manipulation, a lot of stories are being somewhat manipulated, or the context is missing. I mean, that's really what a lot of this is about. It's about context, or missing context, or forgotten context.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've thought about this a lot. We've talked about this a lot, like who would be someone that you would think will be re-examined. And I actually think Kim Kardashian is likely to get this sort of treatment at some point. I mean, the truth is whatever you think of Kim Kardashian, the way she became famous was something that was extremely vulnerable and terrible, right? It was essentially revenge porn. And then she has gone on to build this amazing business, but she is not treated as a businesswoman. Her mother is not treated as a genius, which, I mean, I think whatever you think of Kris Jenner, she has built an empire. And if she was a man, she would be treated as someone who had built an empire. But instead, she's treated as a momager. Like, it's such a derogative way to think about what she's done. So I do think they will be reexamined a bit in sort of future iterations.
I think Paris Hilton is kind of having that moment. Like, I remember her from The Simple Life. And she portrayed that very intentionally. And what I've come to realize now, and she's had that documentary, is that that was a character that she was playing to earn money to win her independence, because she'd been sent to one of those like really terrible like camps for troubled teens.
Yeah, Paris is a really interesting example. I mean, I think, you know, part of what happens in these stories is that in some cases, you know, women do play into these narratives because they are the only narratives available to them. So it's easy to sort of be like, oh, Paris Hilton, she's just this dumb blonde. And she knows that's what's expected of her. So she finds a way to lean into it and actually make a living from it, develop her independence from it. And so, you know, these narratives aren't always imposed externally. I mean, sometimes we impose narratives on ourselves. And that's part of what we're trying to explore with the series. Like, what are the stories we heard? And what did they tell us about the stories we told ourselves? And how did we come to sort of believe certain things about ourselves based on them?
Coming up, we're going to talk about Vanessa Williams, the first Black woman to win Miss America, and had to turn in her crown. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded Podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their Story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. They say hindsight is 20/20. So when we look back at defining cultural moments, we're not only looking back at the events, we're looking back at how we thought or felt at that moment and how we feel about it now. On their podcast, In Retrospect, Jessica Bennett and Susie Banikaram explore these moments from our cultural collective zeitgeist and how we see them now. And I want to talk about Vanessa Williams. Most people know Vanessa as a singer and an actress, but in 1983, she was the first Black woman to win the title of Miss America. And then, about 10 months later, she's asked to relinquish her crown. I guess I want to first start with this moment, because I did not realize until listening to your podcast, Jessica, that Miss America had such a, I'm not sure what the right word is, maybe racist history is the most direct way of putting it, that for the first, what, 20 years, only white women could compete?
I thought you were going to say cultural cachet, because that was shocking to me as well. cultural cachet, and also not even subtly racist, overtly racist, written into the rules of the pageant that Black women could not compete. Later on, they had a rule about how you could not compete if you had ever had an abortion or been pregnant before, which is like, how are they supposed to?
I don't know how they verified that.
Yeah, how do you even verify that? And so when Vanessa Williams wins the crown, it's a really big deal. It's a really big deal. And people are extremely proud. She's extremely proud. And it feels like a moment that we should care about, even though I think, again, by today's account, maybe you don't see the Miss America pageant as something to aspire to or as something that is particularly prestigious. But back then, she was a model of the beauty standard. And it was also about showing your talents. I know I sound like the Miss Congeniality line, but it was about showing your talents. And she, as we now know, she's a Grammy-winning singer. She had incredible talents.
Yeah. And it is kind of a strange moment to think about it, because now when we think about beauty pageants, we think toddlers and tiaras. We think about like stage moms and all of the like crazy reality television shows that we probably have seen entirely too much of. But at that moment, it was a big deal, and it was an even bigger deal in the 60s. I did not realize that like so many millions of Americans would tune in to Miss America every year just to watch it.
I forget what the exact viewership was, but yeah, millions of Americans. It was one of the top watched events, and it had huge budget behind it. And so to compete in it was not just to get all of these accolades and this recognition and to get to meet presidents and heads of state. Like, it was a serious thing, but it was also to get a lot of scholarship money. Again, I sound like the Miss Congeniality line, but you really did get money to help put yourself through college, which is what Vanessa Williams was doing.
And so about 2.5 months before the end of her reign, so she's Miss America, she's traveling the country, and I guess I should mention first that she is met by some pretty disturbing racial backlash. Like, you have this very poignant piece of information that she, unlike her predecessors, couldn't ride in convertibles because the risk of being shot at. So she needed extra security, particularly when she would go through the South. So it wasn't as though the country embraced her as Miss America.
Right. There was some real serious racism that occurred and really scary stuff.
And so then Penthouse gets a hold of photographs of her that were taken by a photographer where she's not clothed and she's posing with another woman. And I'm hoping you can explain how Penthouse obtained these photos, because I had a pretty visceral reaction to this part of the story.
Yeah, so I guess if there's any Gen Zers listening, we should explain what Penthouse is, because now you get your porn online. But Penthouse was a pornographic magazine. It was akin to Playboy, except it had all of the parts. And at the time, so Vanessa had grown up, she was incredibly smart, she was a straight A student, she was it was never in question whether she was going to go to college, but she was also interested in the arts and modeling. And so at some point she gets involved, not romantically, but she gets involved with a photographer. She becomes his assistant. And while she's assisting him, he says, oh, let's take your portraits. And so he kind of gets her to do various stages of undress. There's another woman involved in the photography. He promises these photographs will never be released. They are only for her. And whatever, she goes on with her life. She goes to college. She goes to Syracuse. She later then becomes Miss America. So fast forward, this guy sells the photos to Penthouse. She doesn't know this is occurring until she answers a phone call from, I think it was a New York Post reporter, but I may be wrong, some tabloid, who's saying, oh, I understand that your photos are appearing in Penthouse. And she's like, oh my God. She gets off the phone. She calls her parents. She calls her lawyer. And she's absolutely horrified. And what happens next is that the photos are released. Yes, she's nude. Yes, she's posing with another woman. The storyline becomes, you know, she's a lesbian, which kind of gets to the homophobia of that era. And the pageant says, you know, you gotta step down. Like, there's absolutely no way this flies.
And she has to give a press conference. And, like, we should also keep in mind, she's what, like 20 years old at this time? Like, she is still pretty incredibly young. And she gives this very poised press conference where she essentially says she was told these would be silhouetted image, that they wouldn't be able to identify who she was. She was told that they wouldn't be used for anything, that they were part of a portfolio, and that she essentially misplaced her trust in this photographer who then sold her photographs for money. And the word consent isn't used at the time, but she really did not consent even to the way the images were going to look in the end.
Right. She's, I forget how old she was at the time, but 18, 19 years old. She's young. She thinks she's doing some artsy photo shoot. And in fact, she's nude.
It, to me, I don't know if this is the right, it feels predatory. It feels like a step away from what we might call the casting couch.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, now were somebody to take nude photographs and sell them without a person's consent, there are laws against that. That's literally called revenge porn, and there are laws in many states against it. But we didn't have that language at the time. And so I think she really felt great shame. She felt shame, and she felt like she was bringing dishonor to this pageant, which had many dishonorable things, but that's beside the point for that time. And it's interesting. So she does do this press conference where she announces she'll be stepping down. And Susie, correct me if I'm misremembering, but I don't think she had to do this press conference. I think she decided she was going to do it, and she wanted to hold her head up high, and she wanted to go up there and say, I'm stepping down for these reasons, and I'm not going to go away.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what's remarkable about Vanessa's story. It's similar to Robin's story. What's kind of amazing about these women is that these things happen to them, which I frankly am like, maybe that would have took me out.
You know, I mean? Would crawl, like, in a hole and like never have come back out.
Right. I mean, in Vanessa's case, very similar to Robin's case, there are just all these headlines about her. She is painted as this Jezebel. She sort of feels like her career may be over. But instead of allowing this narrative to be the only narrative about her, she puts her head down, she does the work, and over years, brick by brick, she rebuilds her career. Very similar, the stories of both these women. And I think, you know, part of what's inspiring about these stories is that they are able to have these amazing careers, but that they often haven't been given the credit of what that took, you know, sort of what they were able to accomplish despite the things that they had to overcome. So, you know, in some ways it can feel like, oh, these, you know, episodes are about sad things, but often for me, they're sort of about these amazing people who overcome, you know, really unusual circumstances, but find a way through. And so I find it inspiring a lot of the time. I know it's
well,
a little...
the thing with Vanessa too is, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I knew her as a singer and then later as the star of Ugly Betty. Like, we all remember her playing Wilhelmina on that show, and she was so great, and I think was nominated, if not won, Emmys for it. And I knew nothing about the Miss America. I mean, it's a testament to the fact that she was able to build her career. It was only later when I was reporting on the Miss America pageant, this was in the Me Too era when they decided to get rid of the swimsuit competition, that I stumbled upon the fact that she had been the first Black Miss America. And I was like, oh my God, this is fascinating. And so started digging into it. So yeah, she very successfully built her career after probably never had to speak about it again, though at times she has.
We're getting down to the final minute of our hour together. So, final question might be a difficult one. Do you guys have a favorite episode that you've done?
I mean, I'll say the one episode we haven't discussed. A lot of the episodes we've discussed here are, you know, episodes I absolutely love. But we did an episode about this scandal that involved the Rutgers basketball team, women's basketball team.
I remember
And
this one. Dawn Imus.
And Don Imus, who was a very famous radio host at the time, and he basically, you know, denigrates these young college athletes. They've gone to the championship, and he speaks about them in really disgusting racial terms. And so that's an episode I'm really proud of.
That was Susie Vanacarum, co-host of In Retrospect. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thanks to Jessica Bennett. You can find In Retrospect on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.